Saturday. It's August 9th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in New York.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
And we are two of your Airmail editors who are here to provide you both with a little gossip from Prince Andrew and also a break from the news. But first, here's what's been happening. Well, yet again, it's been a strange week in the news. The actor Dean Cain, whom you may have forgotten about since it's been quite some time since he starred as Superman in the television series Lois and Clark, went on Fox News this week to announce that he has joined the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, known as ICE, to help combat illegal immigration. Lord help us all. Clearly, ICE is having some staffing issues. Can't imagine why. Who wouldn't want to arrest harmless people minding their own business at Home Depot? Because the Department of Homeland Security has reassigned employees from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, to work there. So what if we're in the middle of natural disaster season? Our dystopian American summer continues. As usual, Airmail is the antidote to it all.
Yeah, you know, and as you mentioned, we have a great show. You know, first, there's a new book out about Prince Andrew and his ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, that many people, including Andrew and Sarah, wished had never been written. It's also a book that Andrew and Sarah went to great lengths to bury, and its author, Andrew Launey, will tell us what they were so afraid of. Then, if you live in New York City, you can feel the city is at a crossroads again, and the upcoming mayoral election feels as consequential as the battle in 1989 that saw David Dinkins barely beat Rudy Giuliani to succeed Ed Koch. The historian Jonathan Mahler has written a riveting book about that time, in which reveals how the late 80s in the city foreshadowed this year's mayoral race and the Trump presidency. And finally, one of our favorite guests, Cassie David, is going to tell us about marriage proposals in the age of Gen Z and why popping the question seems to have officially lost all its romance. Kind of sad, Ashley. But where would you like to begin today?
Well, let's start with Andrew Launey and Prince Andrew, because Lord knows we can't get enough of Jeffrey Epstein, and he is a major figure in this story. Andrew is a British historian and the author of several books, including The Mountbattens, Their Lives and Loves. His new one is called Entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello, nice to join you.
Andrew, your new book about the House of York is so illuminating on so many elements of Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson's financial dealings. But because Jeffrey Epstein is top of mind these days, let's start with exactly what we know about their dealings with him.
Well, the dealings of the couple with Epstein go back much earlier, last much longer, and are much deeper than people realized. Andrew claimed that he'd met Epstein in 1999, and we now have people like Steve Hoffenberg saying that it went back to 1991. We know that, in fact, both of them continue to maintain that relationship after 2010, the so-called meeting to say goodbye and break off the relationship. We know that Epstein paid rather more than the $15,000 that Sarah Ferguson has claimed to settle her debts. So I think there's more still to come out. I mean, a lot of this material has come out from legal depositions to do with other separate cases, Jess Staley and others. I suspect this is only the tip of the iceberg, but Andrew had a suite and in the house in Manhattan, which was called the Britannia Suite, because he was such a frequent visitor. We know that she herself stayed in Epstein's homes many times, visited Palm Beach. We have sightings of Andrew on the island with named people, including Denise George and others, with evidence of him on the island, in fact, with Virginia Giuffre. So, I mean, the whole story that's been concocted is unraveling.
Clearly, this was all tied to money and the fact that Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson had accrued so many debts. But wasn't Prince Andrew on the royal payroll at this time? I mean, how did they end up in all of this financial distress?
Well, I'm afraid they're a couple that live, you know, very extravagantly. And, you know, they want to keep up with multimillionaires, and that costs money. But you're absolutely right. There was money that Andrew was given by trust funds, he inherited from the family. But he has been making a lot of money, both when he was special representative, not from being special representative per se, he only had expenses, but from the deals that he did when he was special representative with other people. And one of the concerns that the Foreign Office had was he was arranging to meet people that had nothing to do with promoting British trade and all about promoting Prince Andrew. And, you know, we still don't know the extents of his dealings in the Middle East, in China, how he monetized Pitch at the Palace, and exactly what his relationship was with David Rowlands, who claimed to be basically his financial advisor and who was busy setting up banks and things in the Middle East, helped by Andrew. There are all sorts of offshore companies that Andrew had a share in, either with the Rowlands or with others. Again, the whole thing about royal finances is they're so opaque that it's very difficult to see what's going on. And one of the mysteries I discovered, and I got forensic accountants to look at this, are the number of companies that Sarah Ferguson has, which basically have no transactions running through them and therefore not properly accounted. And so one wonders, why does she have so many companies which are actually supposedly doing nothing?
Well, we know they liked high living, right? They purchased a $24 million chalet in Switzerland. They were living at the Royal Lodge on the grounds of Windsor that, you know, obviously cost quite a bit of money to maintain. But let's linger a little bit on this pitch at palace enterprise, because it seems like one of those rare examples in which the crown is getting down and dirty with business, right? Like they traditionally have tried to keep that element of their empire at least out of public view. How did this pitch at palace concept come about and what was Andrew's involvement?
Well, the idea, which is a very good one, is to be a sort of dragon's den to bring together investors and entrepreneurs. And in many ways, it was very successful. And that was run as a charity. It was had hosted in royal palaces, Buckingham Palace, St. James's Palace. The Queen attended, the Grenadier Guards were there to play their tunes. The problem is that Andrew set up a separate company called Pitch at Palace Global. He was a significant person of control. He had a whole series of directors, and that was making money. That was taking a 2% cut from money that these entrepreneurs were getting from investors in order to bring the two together, which is, I'm told, a no-no in investor circles. And this was, people were confusing the two. But actually, you say that there was a separation between business and the palace. But the fact is that there were events being staged at the palace with businessmen the whole time. Some of the money, sometimes these large banks were paying, sometimes they weren't. And so there's a very, very confused line between the networking that was going on in business circles using royal premises and royal appearances and the connections that were being made and used for the private interests of members of the royal family.
King Charles has distanced himself from his brother over the years for very good reason. What do we know about those inflection points, you know, when Charles started to pull away and strip Andrew of various titles?
It's an interesting relationship. I mean, Charles was a very good older brother. I think there was a period when Andrew became a sort of heartthrob that Charles was jealous of him. Andrew could pursue his career in the Navy. He was good, the one with Robert Redford looks, according to Charles. I think there was a rivalry there. And in fact, I think there was a feeling that Andrew had that he could do a better job than Charles, that he could perhaps be regent if there was an accident. And of course, Charles came very close to being killed in an Alpine accident at one point. But particularly when Charles was having some of his marital problems, Andrew generally thought that he'd be made regent until William could become king. So there was that element. I think at one point, Fergie was seen as a good thing. Charles would say to Diana, why can't you be more like Sarah Ferguson? But I think he kind of got wise to what Andrew was like. He was the one who wanted to make sure he stayed in the Navy rather than go as a special representative, because he thought that was a recipe for disaster. And I think increasingly, particularly since he's become king, he's been concerned about the optics of Andrew living in Royal Lodge when he's no longer a working royal, and the problems that Andrew has brought on the image of the monarchy. So I think that relationship has changed. Now, Andrew and Sarah Ferguson have been brought back within the royal fold in recent years since the Queen died, who was his great protector. That may be partly just because Charles is a nice person. I think it's also a belief that they need to keep Andrew and Fergie within the fold, because clearly they know a lot of family secrets that they don't want out. So I would say it's a very complex relationship. The relationship with William, I think, is less complex. I think William sees that how damaging Andrew is to the monarchy. And I think everything that's been said to me is that as soon as William is king, Andrew is toast.
And Andrew, what do we know about Andrew's finances today? I mean, obviously he's under a fair amount of duress. How is he paying for his bills, and how has he gotten his daughters involved in the family businesses? I mean, it seems like there are so many offshore dealings with bizarre entities in China that seem to be funding their lifestyles. What do we know there?
Well, we know very little, because we don't know about royal finances, and the way they disguise themselves with front companies, with different front men like Dominic Hampshire. A lot of stuff is offshore. He's got Chinese bank accounts. It's really difficult to see what's going on. So we get hints of business that he's doing. These come out from court cases. There's a famous one with a man called Selman Turk in the High Court recently, where large sums of money were being paid to all the members of the family, which the Yorks couldn't explain. We just don't know. And it's really really hard to discover this. They're hiding the way they're making money. And I've been calling for a long time for a royal register. This is something MPs raised 20 years ago, like a parliamentary register, where they would have to declare their earnings and their interests and to see that there was no conflict with their public duties. But that doesn't seem to have got anywhere. They can get away with it because no one knows what's going on.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much. Congratulations on your marvelous new book that everyone's talking about.
Thank you. Well, lovely to talk to you and delighted that there is this interest.
Oh, Michael, this story is the gift that keeps on giving for us journalists. We just can't get enough.
Yeah, you know, you've got Meghan and Harry on one side, Andrew and Sarah on the other. Multi-generational.
Well, we have another new book to talk about that is less royal in nature, but also full of big personalities. It's called The Gods of New York, Egotists, Idealists, Opportunists, and the Birth of the Modern City from 1986 to 1990. And its author is Jonathan Mahler, who's a longtime journalist for the New York Times, a historian of New York City, who's also a bit of a cultural archaeologist and anthropologist. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Well, Jonathan, we are very excited to talk about your new book, The Gods of New York, all about New York City in the late 1980s. What took you back to this particular period?
I was sort of taken back there in 2016, I was at the Times, I was covering the political campaign, and I wasn't assigned to a specific candidate, but I was sort of doing kind of longer pieces about some of the candidates' histories, their pasts. And because I'm kind of a New York guy, a New York historian, I've written about New York a lot in the past, I gravitated toward Trump and Trump in the 80s. And I didn't really want to write a book about Trump. I mean, I definitely didn't want to write a book about Trump, but I was interested. I did become increasingly interested in that kind of milieu. I guess what was his crucible, but really just that whole period of time in the life of the city, the 1980s, just because it was filled with such like huge outsized characters and so many kind of wild, convulsive events that happened during these years. The city just was such a vastly different place that I just kind of found myself captivated by it.
Obviously, these were the years before cell phones and social media, certainly a very different time economically. But what, in your mind, were the most prominent ways in which New York was at a unique moment in its history in the late 80s?
Yeah. So there were a couple of things I would say. Sort of one is just economically, the city had been in the 70s, it was just like really in the dumps. It was broke. It was dirty. It really kind of, you know, seemed like it was in a death spiral. And then in the 80s, it sort of reinvented itself as the kind of center of global capitalism. It was the Reagan era with deregulation. Wall Street was suddenly booming. The city kind of suddenly found a whole new way to sort of live. And that was as kind of, you know, its economy was suddenly fueled by Wall Street and by real estate. So that's kind of one big change, that the city was going through this big kind of cultural and economic transformation. Another big difference, though, is that at that time, the city was, you know, there were three tabloids that were sort of thriving. Everyone read in New York, the New York Post, the Daily News, and Newsday. And these tabloids like kind of had an amazing effect on the life of the city, because they sort of pulled the whole city around the same kind of narratives, the same storylines. So New York had this amazing quality of feeling like it was both, you know, the center of the world and also a small town. And I feel like, you know, we've kind of lost that with the sort of fragmentation of the media. You know, New York felt like one city because everyone cared about the same stories, because the tabloids were serving up the same stories and kind of creating these storylines around them. And that made the city feel kind of like a smaller place in a way.
And the mayor at the time was also an outsized personality who commanded a disproportionate amount of the attention. How does he figure into your book?
Yeah. So, I mean, Ed Koch really is in many ways the sort of spine of the book. I mean, it's a sort of sprawling cast of characters: Spike Lee, Donald Trump, Al Sharpton, Larry Kramer, Chuck D, some others. But Koch is in many ways kind of the central figure, because I sort of build the story around his last term, his last 4 years. And I really kind of came to see him as like just an incredibly sort of sympathetic, and you sort of develop an emotional attachment to him and the kind of arc he goes through over the course of these 4 years, because he kind of, you know, begins as really one of the most popular mayors in the history of New York. And then over the course of these 4 years, everything unravels around him. And he was someone who was, he was so flawed, but he also really, really loved New York and he loved his job. He was out in the streets. I mean, his famous line was, you know, how am I doing? He was constantly engaging with people. And over these years, you could see it all kind of falling apart for him, his kind of emotional journey and kind of, and how that kind of runs parallel to the unraveling in New York during these 4 years. It's sort of the heart and soul of it in a way.
And here we are all those years later, grappling with the prospect of a Democratic Socialist mayor in Mamdani. I mean, what do you make of his ascent and rise? And how does this trace back to the period that you cover in your book?
Yeah, I mean, you can actually really connect the dots pretty cleanly, because this was the moment, the 1980s was the moment when, you know, New York had once, after World War II, been the great working class city, right? It was a city with this kind of diverse, bustling manufacturing and shipping economy, lots of middle class people protected by powerful labor unions. That all unraveled in the 1960s and 70s. And then New York comes back to life as the kind of capitalism on steroids, right? Unregulated city, make as much money as you can. And we've seen over the course of the last 40 years, the trajectory of that has been kind of increasing income inequality. It's harder and harder for a lot of people to kind of find their traction in the city. And now there's a backlash, and that backlash is kind of taking the form of a 33-year-old socialist.
Will we survive him?
Yes. I mean, New York has survived. Look, we survived Abe Beame. We survived Jimmy Walker. We survived Eric Adams. There we are, you know, almost. We've had plenty of mayors who are not always great. And who's to say what Mamdani will do? I think also, I mean, a lot of this is, it's easy to see his platform and you know, and certainly the business community is freaking out. But there are real lots of limits to what he's going to be able to do. I mean, even if he tries to implement this very ambitious platform that is dependent on raising taxes a lot, which is something that he doesn't really have any control over. I mean, you have to wonder how much of this is going to actually happen, but I guess we'll see. We'll certainly survive either way.
John, thank you so much. Congratulations on the book.
My pleasure.
It's called The Gods of New York, Egotists, Idealists, Opportunists, and the Birth of the Modern City from 1986 to 1990, Our Kind of Time.
Awesome.
Okay, Michael, this one I can't wait to read. This guy knows how to weave a tale together, doesn't he?
Yeah, if you've ever read one of his great books, The Bronx is Burning, about New York in that same era, it's great. So and this one is just as good and even better, if that's possible.
If you feel like this episode is lacking romance, you are not wrong. So let's get Kazi David on here to talk about what's happening in the world of Gen Z marriage proposals. Spoiler alert, it's not very romantic. Kazi is a columnist for Airmail and the author of No One Asked for This. Her new book is called Delusions, and it's coming out in March of 2026. Welcome, Kazi.
I'm back, you guys.
There is a God.
Third time the charm.
So, Kazi, wedding bells are ringing in your universe with many friends and family and foes all getting engaged. 'Tis the season. What do you make of all this?
Well, it is wedding season, and I've just noticed since now being this age, I wasn't really able to be that exposed to it in the past, but I've just noticed a really big difference from, let's say, our parents' generation and how they got proposed to and today, and some of the things I've heard, you know, in some of my friend groups and outside of that, how they're kind of going about it. And it's a stark difference, I must say.
I kind of want to blame Sophia Richie because it feels like she was the first person to have a wedding that felt truly sponsored, although I'm sure there were many who came before her. Is that sort of wedding as press event idea extending into engagements?
Yeah, well, the wedding industrial complex obviously has always been like this horrible, massive thing that kind of like tricks people into thinking they need to do all of these things. But that being said, it's like in the same way a wedding's for content now. A baby feels like it's for content. A dog, you get a dog for content. And now it really feels like the ring is for content. And the wedding was something obviously that was like, it's usually planned by the bride. The whole thing's planned down to, you know, every single detail. And I've noticed now that the proposal is becoming just as planned with the bride's involvement. So this is something that I'd never, like that was kind of the one decision that was made without the bride's involvement. And now it's really starting to feel like the woman is very much involved. They know when it's happening. They need to pick out the ring. What made that change? you know, like how did that shift from it being a real question that somebody asks if you want to spend the rest of your life with them, this like romantic, spontaneous kind of moment, well, spontaneous for you, and what it is today, which is that like none of it's a surprise. You know when it's coming, you get your nails done and you've picked out the ring, like, or even designed the ring yourself. And so what that does, it just really makes the whole thing a full performance because you're not surprised and you've seen the ring. So you're just really acting.
I mean, I was struck by your anecdote about a friend of yours who got a Russian manicure every day for like, what, 2 weeks or 2 months, like an insane amount of time, just waiting for that picture to be taken of the nails and the new ring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like she didn't want to. I mean, she's not really a friend of mine. She's a friend of a friend, but she was the one person that her fiance wouldn't actually tell her when it was coming. A lot of these proposals, they know when it's happening. And he was like, it's going to happen sometime in the summer. The lack of control for that, you know, how do you make sure your nails are done for your big post? Got to get them done every week, I guess. So they're perfect.
I mean, this to me is just yet another piece of evidence in the argument that romance might be dead. But tell me I'm wrong about this.
No, I feel like it's this interesting time for this to be kind of happening because we have this whole, you know, shift in like bro culture. And I feel like this is important for men. It's like, it's picking out the ring. You put so much faith in them and it shows so much. Like it shows what they know about you, what they think, what is it going to be a symbol of your love for, you know, generations to come. You know, it's a ring that's supposed to be passed down. It's supposed to be timeless. And now that the control is kind of given again to the woman in the situation, and the woman typically now wants something that's trendy, a ring that's going to do well on social media. The man's input is like kind of irrelevant, which makes the whole thing just like a transaction that he's kind of paying for. And I think I'd like to see more men just stepping up and being like, I'm not going to tell you. And like, maybe we'll even break up. Like, you can't know it should be a surprise that marriage is even in the picture. I feel that's the romance of it.
Hazzy, we're not going to get into your current romantic situation, which I'd quit Instagram. So you may be public about it or you may not, or there might be nothing to talk about. But one day, hypothetically, if someone were to propose to you, how would you want it to go?
I think you want something that's authentic to your relationship and the kind of, I think when it becomes a spectacle in any way, maybe someone would like that. And maybe that's authentic to them, and therefore that should be the thing for them. But I think everyone's different and it should really be with that person in mind. The ring should be with that person in mind, and it shouldn't be fake. You shouldn't be pretending you love a ring that you picked out yourself or that you know, that's Hailey Bieber's ring or whatever it is. But I think the whimsy of the proposal is an important feature of, you know, a marriage. And I'm upset that it's becoming obsolete.
Safe to say no. What did she have, Hailey Bieber? Was it oval or?
So she had an oval, yeah. And that became, after that, by the way, that was a ring that was designed by Justin Bieber with Hailey's essence in mind. And now you have all these women with the same ring that was designed for Hailey Bieber. So it's like, it just has nothing to do with you at all.
I mean, this all seems so quaint, you know, like my husband proposed to me with a drawing of a ring that he had designed that wasn't barely even ready by the time of our wedding. You know, like the idea of me sort of weighing in on that, I never would have done it.
I think if you are with someone that you know they need to have chosen their own ring 100%, then the proposal should still be a surprise. I love the idea of the drawing of the ring. And then you go pick out the ring together once you're engaged and she can design it or whatever it is she wants to do. The idea that you guys have decided to get proposed to, it's the same as an engagement. So there should be no proposal. If you've had that conversation, you're engaged. Like, what's the difference? If you're talking about getting the ring design and you're working on the ring, you should already be engaged. You don't get to have the facade of a proposal.
I mean, Michael, does Brooke even wear, all these years later, does Brooke wear her engagement ring ever? No, because I gotta say, I don't wear mine. It was beautiful.
Oh yeah, she wears her.
Every day?
Yeah.
Do you not wear it because you don't like yours?
Mine's so beautiful and I love it.
Is it because you didn't design yourself?
I didn't design it myself. It's actually gorgeous. I never would have picked it out, but it's spectacular. But it just feels a little chuggy. Chuggy? What's the word, Kazi? What's the new chuggy?
I don't know of a new one. As far as I'm concerned, chuggy is still going strong.
Okay, well, to me, it feels a little choogy to be walking around with a big, big diamond rock on your hand all day long. I'm so sorry. I know I'm going to get hate mail for this, but I wear my Aura ring.
You'll never get more than me, so you don't have to worry.
Okay, perfect. Well, Cassie, this story is so great, and we have to talk just quickly about your book because it's coming out in March, and like we talked about before the show, everyone in our office is already talking about it. What's it called? What's in it? And how can Michael and I pry a copy out of your hands?
Well, I'll send you guys a copy. It's called Delusions, and it's really about the kind of pressures that arise when you turn 29, really. And it's kind of my year from 29 to 30, trying to like get my entire life together to kind of set the next decade up for success. And suffice to say, it does not go as planned.
Well, from where we're standing, you look like you've got it all together. So congratulations. Keep writing, and we can't wait to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, guys. So nice to talk to you.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report, our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it, is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Michael, I just love Cassie. Don't you just want to hang out with her all the time? I just kind of want to have her on every podcast, just like talking about, like having her make sense of the youths for us, the youngs.
Yeah, I'm just not cool enough. I like talking to her, but I'm not cool enough to hang out with her. So I get to have it both ways.
Okay, well, you know what? This actually segues us beautifully into recommendations. I would like to start with mine this week, which is sort of semi-related. So I've been cleaning out a lot of my old things at my mom's house and going through all my old papers and albums and all those sorts of things. Okay, when is the last time you have listened to a CD?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I hadn't listened to one either in about 25 years. Maybe, no, probably not quite that long, but in a very long time. And I was going through all my old CDs and one of my friends was telling me that actually they're recorded in so much higher definition than MP3s or whatever nonsense we're streaming on Spotify these days, that it's really worth listening to. So I got out like my 2005 Bose CD player and started playing my favorite album from 1995, which was the Smashing Pumpkins' Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, now celebrating its 30th anniversary. Shockingly, I still had that CD around in my house. Michael, it sounded amazing. It was so much fun. I listened to all the songs. The sound quality was incredible. And, you know, I've started to want to put a CD player in my car. So I'm sorry to say this, but it made me feel so sorry for people who grew up in the age of MP3s and cell phones and social media and never knew of the delightfully analog time that we used to have. And yes, I realize how old I sound and we should probably move away from this segment right now.
I just see you walking down the street with your Sony Discman, a yellow box strapped to your chest and, you know, your headphones in.
Yeah, that was basically me during all of college. I mean, I found a picture of me from college, like burning CDs. Remember that? Like the era of Napster and like all of that. You know, that's all we did. We would make these mixed CDs. I went back and listened to a bunch of those. They were so good, so much fun. Anyway, it just made me a bit nostalgic. So I think my prediction is that CDs are going to become the new vinyl. Give it 5 years.
All right. We'll check in with you.
Now you, what do you have that you can possibly recommend to us?
Well, you know, speaking of things from 20 years ago, my recommendation is the new season of Platonic is back. Did you watch season one, Ashley?
I did not. What did I miss?
Okay. You know, it stars Seth Rogen and one of your favorites, Rose Byrne. And I bring up the 90s or 20 years ago because the whole conceit is it's just about two friends who were platonic friends, a guy and a girl in college. She got married. He didn't. They sort of come together 20 years later and sort of like get their friendship back going again, and complications ensue, as they say. I think it's great. It's kind of got lost under the radar, if you ask me, on Apple, where it airs, overshadowed a little bit by Shrinking, as well as The Studio, which is also a Seth Rogen kind of thing. But it's one of my favorites. If you haven't seen season one, Ashley, get in line now and then jump into season two. I think it's super smart, very well written, and just a really fun show. It's called Platonic, and it is streaming on Apple TV.
Well, thank you. Consider it done.
All right.
Thank you all so much for joining us. We wish you a marvelous weekend. Michael, will you please read us out?
Absolutely. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.